Are you confused about real food and what's healthy and good for the planet? Do you need the facts about local, organic, and sustainable food? Well, get ready to change the way you eat. Get ready for The Appropriate Omnivore with Aaron Zober.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. I'm your host, Aaron Zober, covering lifestyles in the world of real food. On October 17th, the Weston A. Price Foundation will be holding its annual Wise Traditions Conference, this year in Salt Lake City, Utah. As has been the tradition on The Appropriate Omnivore, I'll be interviewing several of the upcoming speakers. My speaker for this week is Bob Quinn, founder of Kamut International and the Oil Barn, and the recently established Quinn Institute. His Wise Traditions presentation is entitled Healing the Earth by Growing Food as Medicine, a new profit center for farmers and ranchers. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you very much. It's great honor to be here.
And it's an honor to have you on this program. You've been doing this for a while with farming and ranching and lots of accomplishments. And it's amazing now what you've founded with the Quinn Institute.
Well, thank you very much. We're really excited about that. It's kind of my last chapter. I had five kids and none of them showed up at the doorstep to take over the farm. So I decided rather than sell the whole thing and ruin their life with all that money, I would take 600 acres of it, about a quarter of it or so, and create the Regenerative Organic Research, Education, and Health Institute. And so the title of my talk was Healing the Earth by Growing Food as Medicine. And actually, that's the mission of our institute. So that's where I got the idea.
That's great. So this is essentially about the future of farming.
Yes, a little bit about the past, but more about the future and what we might do to modify the direction we're going now to make a brighter future for so many people. We've got 60% of the entire population with at least one chronic disease. That's, to me, not a very bright future. And so I think we need to change that. And we're working on some ways to do it.
Wonderful. So tell us more about the mission of the Quinn Institute.
It goes back to my first conversion to organic, which is now over 40 years ago. So giving up all chemical inputs on my farm, chemical pesticides, herbicides, and chemical fertilizers, and trying to mimic nature. And if we look at how nature operates, there's no monoculture in nature. There's cycles in nature, but the whole thing perpetuates itself. Every organism, plant, animal takes from its environment, but it also gives to its environment. And that's what makes the thing stable and long-lasting. And we're trying to mimic that on our farm. And we find that by doing that, we actually increase the nutritional value of the food we produce. And that then adds to the health of those who eat it. One of the biggest eye-openers to me was the discovery of an ancient wheat that we market now under the brand name of Kamut. And we found that the 85% or so of the 20% of the U.S. population that can no longer eat modern wheat comfortably, get some kind of reaction to it, eats this ancient wheat without any problem at all. And many of them report they feel better after doing so. So that put me on the whole idea. Well, we started doing research to try to understand that. We published 36 peer-reviewed journal articles comparing chronic disease on human volunteers in everything from heart disease to fibromyalgia, and including diabetes and non-alcoholic fatty liver syndrome and so forth. And what we found is this grain was extremely anti-inflammatory. And that put me really on the path to start thinking about food as medicine. And our research institute that is just taking those principles and those ideas to the next level and establishing and looking at crops that we can maybe introduce that focus on nutrition and provide more nutrition than we have with a lot of our crops that we're now currently eating.
So this essentially goes back to what Hippocrates said of let medicine be thy food and food be thy medicine.
That's right. So after 2,300 years, a few people now, a few more, are starting to listen. I don't know how many listened to him in his day, but there's been a long period where we have ignored some of that great advice.
Yes, and it's very much a thing that it's good for both our health as humans and health of the planet.
That's right, because right now, chemical pollutions are, we have most of the wells in Iowa are unfit to drink, especially for children, the water in them, because of contamination of fertilizers. The same problem exists in the Gulf of Mexico. We have a dead zone the size of New Jersey. And how big does it have to get before we think maybe we're going in the wrong direction here with this industrial chemical agriculture based only on high yields? That's the only thing it's based on. And abundance, and then cheap prices in the grocery store. But that's the only place it's cheap. Everywhere else, the ramification of that cheap food is very expensive, almost unaffordable for our society, for our people, and for the health of our nation.
And I would add, of course, because we are talking about the upcoming Weston Price Wise Traditions Conference, and you do include both farmers and ranchers, throw in there that regenerative organic agriculture is good for the animal's health.
Absolutely. Because a healthy animal, then whatever they produce that we're consuming, whether it's the meat itself or eggs or butter or milk or whatever, has a direct bearing on what they eat. Just as we are affected by what we eat, the animals are affected by what they eat. And if we're eating products that they're making with the food they eat, that sense is tied to our nutrition and our health.
You talked earlier in the program how you switched over to organic agriculture in the 80s, and you've touched upon how the Quinn Institute is devoted to regenerative agriculture. So was there a period where then you switched from organic to regenerative?
I felt we were always regenerative, the way it's talked about now. We didn't use that term in the 80s. We used the term sustainable, and we thought that captured what we're trying to do. But then after a few years, Monsanto came out and said they were sustainable, and all the other chemical companies. So then we stopped using that term, actually, because it had been co-opted. And I'm afraid that we see the same thing happen to regenerative. If you go on the Bayer website and their page about regenerative agriculture, it's like they invented it. And that's troubling to me. But if you combine the two ideas of regenerative and organic, then you're talking about a focus of organic from the regenerative side. And from the organic side, you're talking about a legal definition that's hooked to the regenerative side. And they don't have that now. And regenerative to me is much like organic was in the 80s. It was defined all over the place. And it was whatever people defined it as themselves, or said it was. And that led to a lot of confusion in those days and led to the effort of many of us to have a national definition approved throughout the country so that we could really hang our hat on it. And if we combine organic and regenerative, we can do that in one fell swoop without any further legislation or anything. That's why I like the combination of the two.
I do too, yes. And that's a very important point to bring up about how so many different people are using regenerative, and I think it does lead to some confusion among consumers. I shouldn't say some. I think it leads to a lot of confusion among consumers of what regenerative really is.
Yes, because there's some regenerative that's really top-notch and really done in a very good way. And on the other extreme, you could say it's greenwashing at its worst. And then there's all shades in between. So why not give the guys that are really trying to do it right a credit that they deserve? That's what I would say.
Yes. Many different definitions of regenerative by different organizations and people and companies, but we're not talking to those. You're the subject for today. So how would you define regenerative agriculture?
As I mentioned earlier, I'd like to see it tied to organic. And when you have regenerative organic, and that's what we have in the Institute as our focus, regenerative organic research, then you're talking about the type of organic agriculture that focuses primarily on soil health. The big difference between organic and non-organic agriculture is that in non-organic agriculture, farmers focus on feeding the plant and mostly to produce as big a yield as possible. In organic agriculture, traditionally, we have looked at the focusing on feeding the soil and making the soil as healthy as possible, and letting the soil then take care of the plants that are growing there, and secondarily by the animals that eat them too, including us. But now it's possible, and there in some circles a growing focus on feeding the plant by organic farmers, but in an organic way. So it's still, you're skipping the soil part. We even have hydroponics that's labeled organic, and that doesn't use soil at all. And so I think the big advantage of combining regenerative with organic is this focus on the soil and soil health. And the big advantage to regenerative by combining it to organic is having a definition that is based in law and is legal. So that's how I like to define it, so that you have both of those aspects. You have the absence of poisons in your production system, which leads to chemical residues that are not good for us, and it's not good for the environment or the soil either. And then you have the focus on soil health and having a living soil that really can support high nutrition in plants that grow in it.
I like that definition, because a lot of people do wonder what are the differences between organic and regenerative and how you can be organic without being regenerative, which you bring up some cases now of what's mm-hmm. being considered organic. I think also as we look at these different definitions by different groups and people, it's important to discuss the common themes that all of them share. And soil health, mm-hmm. I think pretty much all of them include that. Another aspect that I see a lot of times included with regenerative is animal welfare. What role would you say that plays in regenerative?
I would say animal welfare is tied to animal health. If you have animals under stress, so I've had animals, so we had cattle and we had chickens and pigs. And if you have them under stress, they get sick. And if they get sick, either you let them die or then you start pumping them full of chemicals, antibiotics, and that sort of thing. You can avoid all that. Just like people, stress makes people sick too. But with animals, you can easily avoid that by using principles of animal welfare without having to delineate A, B, C, D, and E, F, G, clear down the whole line, but just doing smart husbandry and giving animals space, giving them good environment, good feed, access to the outdoors when it's appropriate, like in the summertime, that's quite appropriate. In the winter in Montana, it's not too appropriate for some animals. We kept our chickens inside in the winter. We had them outside in the summer. We have our cows outside all year round. So it depends on what kind of animal you're talking about and what their needs are. But I think that rather than having a big list of do's and don'ts, if you can have good husbandry, avoiding stress, that really is the basis in my mind of what animal welfare is all about.
I think so too. I like how you explain the role of animal welfare with regenerative agriculture. I'd say another point often brought up with regenerative agriculture is carbon sequestration. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, that's very important. And that has to do with the life of the soil and the living soil. The more carbon you have in it, the more life there's going to be turning over that carbon and recycling that carbon. And then you also, at the same time, reduce the problem of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere in the form of carbon, carbon dioxide, and whatnot. So you're really killing two birds with one stone. And the amount of carbon that's been released by too much tillage, and that's one thing that regenerative is really big on, is no-till or at least minimum till. The least amount that you can till, the better it off is for retaining that carbon in the soil and not having it escape and be oxidized and leave in the form of gases. So in my mind, they go hand in hand. It's another attribute, if it's done right, of regenerative organic agriculture.
Yes, I agree. And then I think there's also a more recent part of regenerative agriculture some are discussing with it, of improving not just the lives of the soil, the people eating it, and the planet, but also the farmers and farm workers. What are your thoughts on that?
That's really true. If you look at cancer rates in Iowa, it's one of the worst. And it really goes right along with their exposure to chemicals. It's almost true clear across almost all the agriculture of America. When these chemicals first came out, there was no appreciation at all for their danger. We had neighbors who would mix Warbex, which is insecticide, poured on the backs of cattle for grubs and worms with their bare hands. And some of them died of pretty severe cancer and other maladies way before it was pointed out that you shouldn't be touching that stuff or allowing it on your skin or breathing it or anything that we understand now. But if you're not supposed to breathe it or have it touch your skin or be exposed to it, why are we then allowing it on our food? To me, this is a height of hypocrisy and misunderstanding of what's really going on, what the effects of these chemicals really are.
Yes. So I think we have a lot of agreements in terms of what regenerative agriculture is, and that's good. And so I can see a lot of the work that the Quinton Institute has. So tell us now about some of the projects that you're working on with this institute.
Okay, great. We have a 9-year rotation that we've developed on our farm over the last 30 years in Montana, north central Montana, the northern Great Plains, the short grass prairies that we live in. Rotation for most farmers is winter wheat and summer fallow, or now it's chem fallow because they're not tilling anymore. It's no-till, but they're using glyphosate to kill the weeds and save a year's worth of moisture so that they can plant and have 2 years of moisture for one crop. So we only usually grow one crop every 2 years. But we are growing on the off season year that we don't grow the whole season for cash crops. We're growing soil building crops like alfalfa, sweet clover, lentils, peas, that sort of thing, vetch. And we work those into the soil in June at the end of the rainy season for us, which is about 12 inches annually. So it's not really a rainforest exactly. There's no trees here on the prairie, but we conserve the moisture for the rest of that year. And then we're able to use it over the next year. And we are with that 9-year rotation looking at all kinds of different rotation sequences. We're looking at different crops and different nutritional levels. And that's one of the things we're doing. We're looking at different combinations of green manures, cocktails that we're going to be experimenting with, grazing them down rather than haying them and letting the cattle drop the manure and the urine right in the field so that nothing leaves the field and it actually goes to the cow on the way back to the soil. There's been a lot of talk about that, but there hasn't been very much controlled research studies for that. And we'd like to have one here in the Northern Great Plains that maybe could demonstrate the importance of that. So that's one of the studies we're doing. We're also working on a hard white winter wheat for bread that's coming from selections from the small grains collection in Idaho, the USDA Small Grains Collection was collected all over the world. These particular selections came from Turkey, and they were old varieties that were collected in the wild, so they never had any breeding or changing, and most people were hoping to have the same response to them they have to the ancient Kamut wheat, which is a durum-type wheat, actually designed mostly for pasta, but we don't have a similar bread-type wheat, and that's what we're working on. And also working on a strong yellow pigment, which is an indication of strong polyphenol activity, which also helps with antioxidant capacity and anti-inflammatory properties in your body. So again, we're focusing on nutrition first, which is linked to flavors. So flavor is an indication of the nutrient density in your food, if it's not all doctored up with the chemicals and artificial stuff. So that we know that if it tastes good, it's probably good for you and has lots of secondary metabolites, which are good for keeping your body healthy. So that's some of the research we're doing. As far as education and outreach, we're working with nearby Rocky Boy Indian Reservation. We helped them convert 500 acres to organic on the reservation. We helped them get a flour mill and grow some of the Kamut because it's very good for diabetes. And diabetes is like a plague on most Indian reservations. And this is grain that will mediate it rather than aggravate it so that they can now grow their own grain organically, grind it in flour. We're helping them grow gardens this year, and our goal was to grow a pizza. So we're growing the kind of vegetables, or helping them get started, the kind of vegetables that you can put on a pizza. And this fall, here in a few weeks, we'll have a pizza party with the fruits of their labor. So those are the kinds of things we're doing for outreach and education.
Oh, great. And who doesn't love a pizza party? All these projects, very inspiring. And I see that with it, we're also giving more, I would say, definitions of regenerative agriculture, a lot of other things that here talking about, such as crop rotation and rotational grazing.
Yes, and they have buffalo there. And of course, the buffalo were the original mob grazers in America, at least. And so they're trying to duplicate all that and bring back the eating of buffalo meat that's not coming out of a feedlot, but coming off the range. And that's also, I think, a very important aspect that they're doing. And we are augmenting that with what else you can go with them.
I think so, too. And you had mentioned about how the focus of the Quint Institute is on the Great Plains region in the United States. Do you see, though, the work that you're doing as also a model for other regions in the country and perhaps in the world?
Well, I hope so. We're working with Rodale. It has lots of campuses around. They don't have a campus in the short grass prairie of the Northern Great Plains, but we work together as partners in different projects with the Land Institute also in Kansas. It's working with perennial grains and perennial plants that are normally grown as annuals. I visited with an institute in Switzerland, FIBO. It's known as FIBO, which is an organic research center. And also I visited with the folks near Cairo in Egypt, with the SECAM co-op there. And they're also doing dry land, in their case, desert reclamation, and also focusing on regenerative organic agriculture. So I'm trying to reach out to different places all over the world that I know about that are already doing similar things and coordinating our efforts with theirs.
Yes, you're listing a lot of my favorite groups. I love the Rodale Institute and the Land Institute for what they do. And I think that those are perfect ones to partner with and examples of other organizations that I would say get what regenerative agriculture is.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
Yes. And so I know you're the founder of the Quint Institute and you also have a team. What kind of people are you working with on the Quint Institute?
Well, we don't have a big team, but we do have a very accomplished and important team. So we have a full-time research coordinator, Josh Poole, who's just out of MSU a year or two ago. We have this year a couple interns from Montana State University at MSU in Bozeman that were very, very excellent. And we have a part-time friend of mine who is taking care of the books, social media, and all the rest of the logistical things. So we're quite overloaded, but we have big plans for expansion, and it's a 501c3 nonprofit, and hopefully attract some backers who would be interested in helping us out and promoting the kind of things we're trying to promote.
Yes, and so what are some of your plans for expansions?
Well, I mentioned the health aspect of what we're doing. We would like to bring on board a health practitioner who would be focusing on chronic disease primarily and be able to prescribe not pills from the pharmacy, but food from the farm. We've seen this done at Ethos in New Jersey, in the Long Valley of New Jersey, and very successfully, and we'd like to mimic that program. We think that gives people really a chance in one place to see the importance of starting with good seed, placing it in living soil, harvesting it at peak nutrition, and then minimally processing that crop to produce food, which is not just nourishing, but healing for you. And this is what we'd like to be able to demonstrate to farmers and gardeners and eaters all over, whoever would like to come and visit us or look up our program on the website or whatever they'd like to do to get more information. And we'd like to be able to have programs which encourage that, which help teach people how to plant gardens and orchards, how to prune them, how to care for them, and then how to process. We want to have a teaching kitchen that teaches people how to process. One thing that we have in the world, in fact, half the food grown in the world is wasted. In developed countries like the United States, most of that waste comes after the processing or during the processing, distribution, eating, storing in the refrigerator until it grows green with mold and then thrown out at the restaurants just because people don't eat the whole portion they're given. If we were able to help people repurpose leftovers and think about not throwing food away, we could cut our food bill in half. That means we could pay twice as much for our food, quality food, than this cheap, high-cost food in the grocery stores by utilizing it all and not wasting any of it. That could be a big advantage for all of us, I think. And so those are some of the kind of things that we want to include in our educational programs and our health aspects of the Institute.
The educational and health aspects, I think, are both fascinating that you're including those in. I love that you're including that in as well as the agriculture. I think that fits very well with the themes of Weston A. Price, and I'm sure that will go over very well with people that are attending the conference. So you would say that then, in addition to working with farmers and ranchers, there very much is a consumer aspect of the Quinn Institute.
That's right, and I don't really like the term consumer so much, but I like the term eaters because we're all eaters, and we should be all producers too, even if it's only growing a plant in a pot in our kitchen window. Up to a full-size garden that produces all of our food. You don't have to have a farm to grow food. We can all grow a little bit. Some we're limited, of course. Everybody's limited, but they're not shut out. And I would like to help people reconnect with their food by growing some of it. My goal is to try to grow everything I eat and eat everything I grow. If I'm up to about 85% now. When I'm home, about 85% of what I eat, or more than that in the summertime, is what I'm growing right off the farm. And I'd like to encourage people to think more about that. And participate at whatever level they can, at some level at least. And then learn how to cook out of their garden, what to do with a turnip. These things that people really don't buy in the store because they don't know what to do with it. And they're not so expensive when you buy vegetables raw and then take them home and cook them yourself or prepare them in tasty fresh meals yourself. So that's the kind of thing we'd like to help people understand, whether they're farming or not. So it's for farmers, but also for any size of farm, clear down to the kitchen window gardener in their pot.
Right. So homesteading, which is an important concept to address. And for people that live in urban areas and maybe they want to do more than just grow food in pots, would you recommend people join community gardens?
Sure. And some communities have very good examples of this where they've turned abandoned lots into community gardens. I would really love to see more and more of that. Instead of just having a fenced, a boarded up lot full of junk, let me clean that off and turn that into a community garden. That could be a huge service to the community. Why not open up kitchen schools after hours for teaching and helping people to can and preserve those things, teach them how to dry, how to ferment, how to pickle, how to can, all this stuff that they could preserve or buy stuff at farmers markets at peak production, which the prices are a little bit lower usually than in off season, and preserve it in some way, and also the fruits of their own labor in their gardens. I think that all that could be tied together to make a big contribution to our health and to the type of food we grow and eat.
I think so too. And I want to go back a little bit to a point you were bringing up about food waste. And we are seeing now use of products that would otherwise go to waste, such as ugly vegetables, as they're called, and
Yeah.
food that is in excess. And we're seeing a concept known as upcycling, which I think is amazing, of using these products to make other
Yeah, that's
things.
really good. That's really important. And you're right. I even heard a report on USDA. I had a report on the radio here a few weeks ago of reusing leftovers, for example, too. And so all that is really important. And some fruits and vegetables, the whole goal has been so beautiful and pristine that I think the best use for them is in a photography lab and taking pictures of them because they aren't fit to eat. They have a flavor, but they look beautiful. So let's take pictures of stuff we want to look beautiful. That's our goal. And not use that kind of criteria to buy and eat the food that we consume because, in most cases, it doesn't matter how it looks so much as how it tastes. That's what's important. And if it has a dimple in it or a potato has a brown spot, you can peel that out real easy. And most of the potato is still good. If you have a melon that's got a little bit of a soft spot, well, it's getting ripe and it could be the most delicious stage of the melon. And maybe you would have to cut out a little bit of a loss for the brown spot, but the rest of the melon could be just fabulous. I think that we need to be thinking more in those lines and taking a different look at our food. It's not a fashion show. The grocery store shouldn't be a fashion show. It should be a nutrition shop, a place to be healed. And that's what we need to figure out how to label those kind of things better and help people understand that. But that's the direction I'd like to see us go.
Me too. And also, a lot of foods that we eat, of course, it's important to eat whole vegetables, but there's other things such as tomato sauces that we eat that you're not looking at the tomatoes. So, ugly
Yeah.
tomatoes can make a great contribution
That's
to producing our pasta sauces and pizza
That's right.
sauces.
That's exactly right.
Yes. And I know something that we're seeing now a lot with different regenerative organizations are labels certifying that the products are regeneratively grown. What are your thoughts on these regenerative labels?
Well, depending on what their source is, if they've got criteria that they're using and then they're saying this guarantees we're following this criteria, that's positive. I think that's very positive. And that's how organic started out too. We had many different certifiers in the 80s that were all certifying to different rules and regulations that they agreed on as certifiers. Some were public and some were co-ops and some were government agencies, but they all had at least a list of rules and regulations that they've followed. Some states, however, had no organic laws on the books, and you could call organic whatever you wanted in those states. And that's the frustration or the little bit of the downside of some of the regenerative stuff now. People are calling it regenerative without any set of rules or regulations. That's what I call the greenwashing part. If they've got a good set of rules and regulations that's followed and that there is verification, that's great. And then people have something they can count on in the supermarket when they're buying those things. But if it just says regenerative without any explanation, it's no different than natural. It'll go the way natural went, I guarantee you, in a few years for sure. And that's too bad because that's a loss of something that could be a good resource for us.
I agree that there is a lot of products now that they're just saying we are regenerative. And for me, as a blogger and a podcaster, when I cover these, I need to see something more than just you say it in the label. I'm not going to just use it in the eye of the company saying they're regenerative. Labels are certainly a great way to have proof that you are regenerative. I know there is some downside to some of what the labels do, but there needs to be something. If not a label, then perhaps providing videos of the way the farm works, showing that there's crop rotation.
There should be a place you can go and see what that means, what the label means. In the early days of organic, before the national law, there were the certifiers that had published rules. You could go to their website or write them, and they would send you what the rules and regulations were. And they were designated on the labels. It was OCIA, Organic Crop Improvement Association, CCOF, the California Certified Organic folks, Oregon Tilth, Texas Department of Agriculture, Colorado Department of Agriculture had a list of rules. Anyway, those certifiers that had their name on the label that went with organic, it wasn't just organic, it's organic by somebody, then you can have a lot of confidence in that. And I would say that the regenerative labels, if they have the same format, they say regenerative according to blah, 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 XYZ, well, then you could look up XYZ and see for yourself what that meant. If it's just bare out there by itself, it could be anything.
Yes. So it's important to have some sign of what regenerative is, have some information
Yeah,
about.
it's a fair question. It's a legitimate question, a reasonable question, and a fair question.
As you've explained, you've been working on this since the 80s. It was then organic, but essentially it was the principles of regenerative agriculture. And myself, being a member of the Weston A. Price Foundation for about almost 15 years now, I've certainly learned really early on what regenerative agriculture is. But we are seeing more people learning now about regenerative. I heard that at the Natural Products Expo West at the beginning of this year that this was the first time that buyers, the retailers, the supermarkets were truly interested in regenerative products. 10 years ago, would you have thought that regenerative has caught on the way it is now?
Well, I'm really not following it as a movement the way I'm following organic. I know that organic now makes up 6% of the entire food market is organically certified in America. In 35 years, that's gone from near zero to 6%. I don't know where just the regenerative market is, and I don't know if it's being tracked now in the same way because of the labeling, how they're tracking, if there is any tracking, how it's being done. I'm sure there is tracking because you hear that it's growing, but I don't know any numbers of how it's growing. But I'm really happy to see the idea, the focus on soil that regenerative brings to the table, growing and growing, because I think that's where it starts. As I mentioned earlier, I don't really favor using one term or the other one in isolation. I really prefer to use them in tandem so that you have the best of both worlds. But I think any movement toward building our soils and reducing our chemical load and contamination of our earth is positive, and I applaud that. I'm frustrated when people say that they have arrived and now they're better than organic or they're better than anything else, but they still use just a little bit of glyphosate to get us through. I think that they're stopping short of an ultimate goal that really is the best of both worlds. And on the other side, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a little frustrated with some organic folks that are focusing on feeding their plants instead of feeding the soil, like potted blueberries, for example, or something like that, that don't touch soil. I'm not very enthused about that either. To my mind, they both have regenerative and organic, as I mentioned before, both have Achilles heels that could both be eliminated by combining the two ideals. And that's what I'd like to see.
Me too. So you're certainly making the case that it's important to have both regenerative and organic, that they both have specific functions and people are going to want to have both of those things.
In the end, I hope so. I don't care where people start and they progress, but I hope that they will continue to progress to the ultimate goal where both are part of the definition of what they're doing. So that's what I would see.
I think so, too. A question that I've asked a lot of guests is, can you be regenerative without being organic? And I think they are very much related, but I also think that a lot of people will always want to hear the term organic as well as regenerative.
I think so, because it has a definition that is well understood, and yet it's extremely broad. And the regenerative aspect of it focuses that down to where I think most of the people who are really interested in the long game and the ultimate solutions to the crisis we're in with pollutions and health and everything see the value of having the two combined.
So something that I also think is interesting is, as I've been attending a lot of these trade shows for the food industry, and I've seen a lot of growth of regenerative products in there, one of the biggest areas that I saw a growth in this past year are wheat and grain products. So I think that's interesting also that you've started this at a time where we are seeing more regeneratively grown wheat and grains.
Mm-hmm. And I'm excited about that. But let me tell you another aspect we haven't touched on, and that is ultra-processing. You can do all the best type of agriculture, regenerative organic, and planting high nutrient dense seeds with high nutrient potential for production. And then at the end, and taking wheat, for example, I'm a wheat farmer. I know this is near and dear to my heart. They take wheat and they make white flour out of it. They throw away a third of the nutrition, goes to the pigs. The pigs are eating better than we are. What is the matter with that? What is the matter? That is a big problem in the industrial food system we have in this country. We are so focused on mass cheap production and how things look. White flour looks more pretty, so goes the theory, than whole grain flour. And it's lighter and airier and all that kind of stuff, as you would know, the American air bread of the last 50, 60, 70, 80 years. But yet the nutrition of it is not at all standing up to what it could be or what it started out to be when it left the farmer's field as whole grain. So I think that is also an important aspect to add to the conversation before we're completely done. It's not only what we do in the farm, it's also what we do in the processing facilities that either adds or preserves the nutrition we get off the farm or undermines it, takes away and add bad things like the color dyes. At least we're starting to talk about that and
yes,
do something about it. But there's other things that we're still adding that are just for preservatives and things that probably are not adding any nutrition and may be detrimental to our health.
Right. In addition to refining grains into white flour, there's also adding these synthetic vitamins into the flour mixes, I would add.
Right, yeah. Which if you used whole grains, you wouldn't have to do that. So at least, and you have all the fiber you need for your gut microbiota. There's more bacteria living in your gut than human cells in your body. But yet we don't think about them. We don't take care of them. We need to feed them. Fiber is an important part of their diet. And when you eat white refined flour without any fiber or bran in it, you're starving some of the helpers that are placed there in your gut to keep you healthy and strong.
And as I've learned more about whole grains with doing this podcast, my involvement with Weston A. Price, one of the things I found fascinating is the crop hard white, because that's one which is a lighter flour, but it's naturally lighter.
Yeah, that's what we're excited about because of some bakery friends of ours asked us to help them with this project. They wanted to use hard white wheat in their baking, but had no good source for it, or they had some, but they wanted an improved source. And so that's what we're really trying to focus on because we don't have the tradition of whole grain the way they do in Europe and darker breads. And so there's a resistance to that when people see it in the store. But if you have something that is tan instead of dark brown, or in the case with these yellow flowers, when you bake that, it's a golden color. And when you make toast, it's even more golden. It's very appealing to the eye and a wonderful flavor to the mouth. And so you've got with a wonderful aroma. So your sight, smell, and taste are all positive indicators rather than negative ones. That there's some people are turned off with dark brown bread. And so we're hoping that that will be an easier move for people thinking of moving away from white bread, but not really being enthralled by dark brown bread.
Me too. Yes, I've become a big advocate of that. So speaking of grains and flours, as we've touched upon, you've also founded Kamut International. Are there any developments with that in terms of new products?
Well, the biggest source of products is really Italy. They have over 3,000 different products now, which is about 90% of the world. But in America, the Food Nanny is probably our biggest and fastest growing customer. And they're using just a myriad of things with the sourdough pancake mixes, for example, and ready-to-use type mixes that bring convenience to whole foods and to nutritional foods. And I'm very excited about that. They have all kinds of different bread products and rolls and pastries, cinnamon rolls, things like that in their stores that are just wonderful examples of what you can do with the Kamut, the fresh baked products. So they are really making a big effort and a new frontier for product development and introduction to the households of America.
You're making me hungry with these sourdough pancakes.
Ah. Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorite. We try to have some every week, at least once a week at our house. So.
Me too. And sourdough, that's another important thing to bring up with wheat, because that's the traditional way of preparing grains is by fermentation. And I think that's nothing that's lost with how we prepare grains.
Yes. And another thing on that, Aaron, that a lot of people don't have trouble, as much trouble at least, with sourdough that they do with the normal bread out of the stores, which is often now made with fast rising yeast. And the yeast has so little time to act before the bread is popped into the oven. It's just digesting the sugar to make carbon dioxide gas to raise the bread rather than breaking down the proteins and the complex carbohydrates in the flour. And so all those complex gluten molecules that are now made quite a bit more complex to hold more air in the bread are not pre-digested. In sourdough, if you let that sit for a couple of days, 90% of the gluten is gone. It's broken down into simpler compounds, which are half digested, and it makes the rest of the digestion of wheat very easy on the system. And some people who have problems with the larger compounds then have no problem with the smaller ones if they eat sourdough-based products.
Right. The sourdough has the fermentation in it, which is a live culture versus the other wheat products. They use a dead pasteurized yeast, as well as sourdough has a lower glycemic index.
Yes, and it's not only that what they're using for cultures, it's the time that those cultures are allowed to work. The fast rising yeast I mentioned earlier is just a matter of minutes or hardly hours, whereas this fermentation by sourdough is at least overnight and usually many hours and sometimes even more than a day, particularly if it's refrigerated and acting slowly. And so that's a huge difference. Sourdough contains a myriad of several different cultures of yeast and bacteria, where fast rising yeast is just a yeast product of a monoculture, you might say. And so the activity that it's performing is much different than the fermentation of sourdough, even though they're both fermentation. But in one case, you're mostly fermenting sugar. And the other case, you're actually fermenting the wheat dough and the proteins and carbohydrates that are in that dough.
Right. That's a very good point to bring up, because there is fermentation still with baker's yeast, but it's not the same kind of fermentation at all as what goes on with sourdough.
No, and it's nowhere near the time allowed for action to happen.
Right, which really that's in a nutshell what's become problematic and why we've gotten all this chronic illness, is because we've found shortcuts to take and we've started doing everything faster, and slow food is the way to go.
Yes, I'm a member of Slow Food Movement.
Yes,
too.
Great organization.
I think they're fantastic, and the principles that they teach are right, the lockstep with what I believe also.
Me too. And in addition to Kamut International, you also have the Oil Barn. Is there any recent news with that?
I started the Oil Barn to produce High Oleic safflower oil that was cold pressed, not refined. So you've got two things. Of course, vegetable oil is getting a bad rap these days, but the refined vegetable oil deserves a bad rap because it's not good for you.
Exactly.
They are extracting the oil with hexane. They say, oh, it all comes out, but it doesn't all come out. And they also use very high temperatures, which cause carcinogens to form, which is another problem with the processed oils, the manufactured oils, refined oils. With cold pressed or safflower, high oleic, we're using fatty acid, oleic acid, which predominates 85% or so of the fatty acid in high oleic safflower is oleic acid, and it's good for the heart. It's very stable. It doesn't break down into trans fats. As you cook for a long time, you start to smell it. And then you can discard the oil when it's done being used for cooking way before it becomes a serious problem to you. But it lasts a lot longer because of its stability in cooking. And so one of the things that I've actually sold that business now, because in an effort to retire and simplify my life, I sold my snack food company called Big Sandy Organics, which makes the Kraft and Kamut snack food, and the Oil Barn, which made the High Oleic safflower oil. We were supplying, one time I sold it, all the oil from Montana State University and University of Montana, and we would get back the used oil, and then I would clean it up, dewater it, filter it, and I could put it in my engine. So I could actually sell it twice. And so the big discussion in the country these days about using soil for food production versus fuel production, I wonder if we use it first for food and then for fuel. So we use the same crop for both just by utilizing the whole thing and not having any waste. What would that do to rural America, the economy there? We keep all of our fuel dollars circling in the community from the farm aspect. We don't have enough oil to drive the cities, but we have enough oil, at least in Montana, from all the fry houses in Montana to run all the farms in Montana. Why couldn't we do this and focus on that and help the local economy? And besides recycling, it becomes a renewable energy then. And so you're not putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere from stored fuel, but you're putting it from plants that had extracted it to grow soils in the first place. So it makes a wonderful loop to think about and to talk about and to promote.
All right. Well, this is beautiful. Everything that we've covered, because we've covered agriculture, health, cooking, and even renewable energy, four of my favorite topics.
Oh, great. It's been fun to be with you.
Yes, we're just about out of time. But before we go, let the listeners know where they go online to learn about the Quinn Institute and Kamut International.
Well, that's real easy, because you can just go for Kamut, Kamut.com, Kamut.com. And Quinn Institute is Quinn, two N's on Quinn, Institute.org, O-R-G. And at those two websites, you'll find an explanation and while we're doing our research, our different products and our goals and our mission statements.
And if people want to check out social media to learn more about them, where can they go?
Again, either one of those websites are connected into our Instagrams and social media.
Perfect. Bob, Thank you so much for coming on. Always great to have you on, and I can't wait to hear your talk at the Wise Traditions Conference.
It'll be good to see you again there too in Salt Lake.
Yes, that will be great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. That's all for this episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. New episodes of the show are released every Wednesday. Follow me on social media for more information on the next episode. And to make sure you never miss any of my podcasts, subscribe to The Appropriate Omnivore on your favorite podcast site or app. You can also listen to all my podcasts on my website, appropriateomnivore.com. There you can find recipes from the guests I interview, plus all of my articles covering lifestyles in the world of real food. Until next time, my pantry is officially closed.